I ring the bell three times and I end with one. And I do a little guided, but that's it. Or a little talking, but not much. All right, here we go. All right, as the body is always present, the first foundation of mindfulness is awareness of the body in the body. And our posture and our breath is our places that we can access at any time until the last moment. And I'll talk a little bit about both. Just as a way to focus your attention, and in the focusing, then we are present. So it isn't so much, hopefully not work, as just focusing ourselves, a little constancy with our awareness, and the result then is calm from concentration. Mindfulness is to remember to do it. Lucky for you, I will help you remember in this short little meditation in terms of the guided part. And then you'll be on your own to practice with what's offered or your own practice currently. All right, in the Zen tradition or the Soto Zen tradition, we like to start with the posture. So really just come into how your body is being held right now, if it's helpful to scan it from head to toe or feet to head, just kind of in the scanning, where is it that it feels supported? And this can be in sitting, lying down, walking, standing, whatever posture that's useful for you right now. To have a sense of really being supported so that you can feel the centeredness and the settledness of your presence in the body. And then in the insight tradition, the focus is usually on the breath at first. So perhaps today, just noticing the wind as you inhale and the wind as you exhale, any portion of it. If you're able to notice the beginning, the middle, and end of each part, that just helps to steady the focus, the attention. Constancy, or the length, the duration of focus, is what supports the unification of concentration to give you samadhi or a sense of composure. So that's part of that instruction. And then for some of us, breath or body can be a difficult, or the posture can be difficult places given situation in life. So if it's useful for you, for some people, a sense of auditory is a great way to focus your attention at first. Perhaps the sound of your breath, or the sound of what's happening inside your homes, apartments, your neighbors, the wind, the breeze outside, blowing a leaf, a car or a vehicle passing by. One way is to let your attention go to it, and perhaps not identifying it so much, because that tends to bring a lot of discursive thinking. Is it right or wrong? Is it a large car, big car, small car, truck or not? So perhaps more, where's the beginning of hearing? The constancy, you stay steady with the sound as long as you can hear it, and then the end of it. So it's a way to focus again our attention and the sustaining of attention builds concentration, the result of which is settledness. And with the unification, then composure. In the insight tradition, often you're instructed to close your eyes if that's not working for you. In the Zen tradition, we have our eyes slightly open, just looking down. That really helps if disassociation is a familiar or a go-to, but it doesn't bring a sense of settledness. So having your eyes open, perhaps even noticing specific items, naming their colors, that might help you to just steady your attention, feel the presence of your being right here and right now. So these are some offerings of ways to focus your attention and feel the result of settledness, calm, and composure. Enjoy. All right, as we're drawing to the close of this formal meditation time, I encourage you to find a sense of uplift. Could be a literal sense of lightness. It could be an intentional one where, in hearing that, part of me wants to, and I'm going to do right now, is just to deeply inhale. And so in doing that, I literally feel my chest lifting up. With the full inhale, I feel a lightness emotionally, mentally, sense of fullness, of presence, of the air, giving me oxygen. And so feeling really uplifted by that inhale. Perhaps it's bringing forth a metta phrase. May I be happy. May I feel well. Or compassion phrase. May I be patient with myself. May I love myself as I am. And may we all care for each other as we deal with challenges. May we all know well-being. Some way that helps you to feel an uplift. And that is actually a felt sense and something that you can access or cultivate, be it with a phrase, a thought, an intentional, both in thought and action. Any ways that you can offer yourself or offer each other through a wish or an offering. A sense of being held in an uplifting, supportive way. Be quiet for just a few more moments as you access that and feel the result. Really know it in body, heart, and mind. All right. Thanks everyone for that. Is there any question about the meditation? Actually, I'm gonna go, schedule me for something about my book, and we both forgot there was this one that she had scheduled, because they schedule like early then later, and then I was like, hey, this is just before the book launch, which is next Tuesday. It is going to be in person at Book Inc. in Berkeley, if anybody wants to show up. It's at 7 p.m and we're actually going to live stream it. You can find it on my webpage. We'll be putting the link in soon, because we have to set it up with the Book Inc. So home is here, practicing anti-racism with the Engage Eightfold Path. So this book started out not as a book, but as a response, I like to say, because it's true. As a manuscript, it actually came because I led a series of classes, including two classes, one round each at Spirit Rock in 2020 and 21, the Dharma being anti-racist and Lotus Rising from the Mud. So it was actually as a class series, it was in response to in early 2020, given my appearance and being, I had a lot of calls from students of Asian heritage or ancestry, Asian American who, or Asian diaspora, who were really distressed for all the anti-Asian violence that was happening at the time, or an uptake in it for sure. And I actually, though, have been formulating these engaged Four Noble Truths, of which, of course, the Eightfold Path is part of, the fourth. Actually, in 2017, I went to a Gen X teacher conference, and that was around the time in which there were a lot of sexual misconduct that had been revealed in a lot of convert Buddhist communities. Another round. And so they brought in right use of power. Have people heard of that? It's a fantastic system talking about how there's always a power relationship. So an up power and a down power in every relationship. For instance, right now, I'm in the up power, right? Because I'm in the teacher's seat. I have the mic. And however, on a certain level, I'm also in the down power if we're talking about in the system of race. Because as a person of color, in the system of white supremacy, I have less power, right? And so it's very dependent, and it's interconnected. And so while this book started out as a book to go with those courses that were addressing anti-racism, first for Asian American and Lotus, and then with the murder of George Floyd, then also for all races, and that's what the Dharma being anti-racist. And essentially, the Engaged Four Noble Truths is very specifically as a restorative model. Write the name of the book. Can you do that? Thank you, Kristen. So there's a link too, I think, on that resource page. And the subtitle, I guess we can add. So the Engaged Four Noble Truths, is off of the Four Noble Truths. Oh, so all these workshops and thing, including at the Gen X Teacher Conference, I love the right use of power, but how many of you attended Buddhist, anti this meeting or sexual harassment meeting or whatever? And there are always things that are brought in. Nonviolence communication, or gosh, for a while in the 90s, it was some book about, I can't remember now, about communication or whatever, right? Which is all great. I like them and I love right use of power. But I kept thinking, well, in Buddhism, there must be something. And the Four Noble Truths, of course, are fundamental to all the sects of Buddhism. And I'm not really, they're beautiful, fundamental. So this is just a reframing. And in the engaged version, it's very much saying if we start out as a restorative model, then we say that hurt and harm has been done. So that's the first noble truth, as opposed to in life there is suffering, right? So, and then that is because to restore a issue that has become a problem or is torn or is broken, we actually have to say something is wrong with it. And to frame when we call that out, or when we, especially as activists, bring forth point towards that, we're actually saying, hey, we have some values that we have uphold and we talk about upholding together, and it's not happening. So it's actually saying, hey, we have an idea, we have values of a sense of interconnectedness and wholeness, which is a very basic to Buddhism, certainly. And yet somehow it has been disrupted. And how is it disrupted? So that's how it starts out. And then the second is similar to the regular second noble truth, which is there are origins to dukkha. And in the engaged version, we're really saying what are the causes and conditions and focusing much more on the systemic conditions to really point towards that it isn't just a self practice, or that your suffering is not by your own fault. Neither is it necessary just by any kind of singular fault, right? Yes, it can be. We do practice the, oh, where's the dukkha I can do something about versus the dukkha I can't do anything about. And we do practice saying, well, what in individuals say culture, but that's a system that has taught me certain ways, and now it's not useful anymore, right? Many of us have been so then it comes down to in the second noble truth to what was it that I was taught as values I should uphold or live by, but now are no longer useful to me. For many of us as queers, or any position of down power, oppressive in the down position and any oppression, we actually have to investigate that a lot more, you know. And in fact, our healing comes when we realize that it's a systemic thing and not just an individual thing. And by systemic, I don't just mean that there's system that make it happen, which for sure it is, but it's also that our approach to how to solve it is also can be systemic. You know, in the popular mindfulness sense, that can really be a sense of, you know, I'm responsible. If I don't rethink the way I think, if I don't behave differently, then, you know, I'm going to continue to suffer, and, you know, I'm just fucked if I don't, you know, change my way, right? When it's really whole systems that either support you to change or not change, teach you a certain way, teach you even how you should change. And as oppressive people, we oppressed people, excuse me, we know that systems tell us how we should be. And so much of our liberation is to go, wait a minute. Well, that's that how you tell me how I should be isn't actually life sustaining for me. And in fact, it's hurting and harming me. So as a restorative model, we have to agree that something is wrong, and that we want to, and in this way that I want to talk about it, we want to say that when we say something's wrong, we're actually saying wholeness has been disrupted. So there's a imagery, I think more in the Zen tradition, but maybe some of you know Indra's net. People have heard of Indra's net. So in the Avatamsaka Sutra, there's an image that's often talked about where we are like jewels on a net, right? And wherever the strands of a net cross, that's a jewel. And so, like a spider web, or often you see, I don't know, other like any kind of net system. So, at the strand, there are jewels. And the nature of jewel is to have facets that reflect. That's just the nature of jewels. And so, in that reflection, we reflect each other. And this is how we inter-are. You know, sounds great, right? I'm reflecting you, you're reflecting me. And I think there's truth to that without a doubt. But what, and the problem with that is then it's all individualistic, or it's only the focus is on individual. I'm reflecting like this. How come you're not reflecting like this? Or, you know, if only you polish like this, the way I think you should polish, then you would reflect better me or yourself or whatever. So what I wanted to bring in was a sense that the net is what we're going for wholeness. You know, it's like when we I don't know. Many of us have gone to practice discussion or interviews or whatever and bring up something and they're like, oh, yeah, well, that's just not Buddhism, you know, just, or, you know, this is just not what we're talking about. You're stuck in a sense of identity and self. And when you get over that, then you're in this oneness that is here. Now, I think there are ways, of course, that we could get stuck in identity and in ego. And for many of us in the oppressed, the down power position or location, it's the oppressors that are telling you that you're not being a certain way, a certain kind of jewel. And so they're oppressing, but they frame it in a way that you're missing out. And only when you let go of your sense of identity, then, you know, you would know oneness, when they are actually saying this is the identity you should have, right? Gender identity is one of those, right? Where we're told that we should appear a certain way, act a certain way, dress a certain way, talk a certain way, right? So we understand that. So then the third noble truth is, classically, is there is a way to end dukkha, and the Eightfold Path is that. So in the engaged version, the third is that where do we find agency, both self and collective, in the midst of hurt and harm? To remember that we have agency. That it isn't just, that's just how it is. That's your karma. You can't do anything about it, right? And that takes not only you, but groups of us. It's similar to when, for me, it's similar to when I realized that homophobia is the problem, not me. Does that make sense? Like the system is the issue, not me. Doesn't mean that I don't suffer, and then the system doesn't make me suffer. And so my work is how to not overcome the structure, though that's part of it, but it's also how do I inhabit a location that's not defined by someone else or by a system, right? How do I negotiate that? But to see it as a system, to me, was where the healing comes, right? As opposed to, oh, I'm just a weirdo, which is how, we're talked about. That's the kind of stereotype and the way that we are put down, right? So of course, the Eightfold Path is that. And the beauty of the Eightfold Path is it gives you like what is skillful as a view, as a the way you should think and motivate. And by I say should think, it isn't about the content of how to think, but what happens when you think and how you can cultivate thinking that is more uplifting or specifically metta, right? Goodwill, compassion, and non-delusion, right? So, okay, that's a quick summary. And wholeness then is the net. Now, today I wanted to talk about a little bit in skillful speech. And because, of course, intersectionality, like, yes, I'm Asian. Yes, I'm a person of color, but I'm queer. I'm a, for the most of my life, female. And so gender and appear for the most part. And, or when I speak, I don't know about appearance these days, but when I speak, most people will go, oh, it's a she. And then there's certain biases and assumption and, lack of power. And then, of course, and then class or ability or whatever. Okay. So, while again, this book is focused on race because of those conditions that call forth the manuscript, then became a book to accompany those classes. It has stuff about me being queer because that's just part of my life, right? So, in chapter 7, it's skillful speech, which is part of there's three sections. It's in the second grouping that's called "What the World Needs Now," skillful speech. Shifting speech to wholeness. And there are four parts, but today I just talk about one. And one of it is I'm calling it uplift, right? And so part of it for me is how do we heal and work to restore ourselves? And part of that is to listen to ourselves, because a lot of skillful speech is about deep listening. And we listen to how we have internalized homophobia, right? So here's on page 135. When I came out, I'm gonna do it from here. When I came out, part of my healing was overcoming internalized homophobia brought on by the damaging ways of mainstream media and society, the way you talked about queer people. My first exposure to the term queer came from a game learned in childhood. A year and a half after I was adopted, my parents moved us from Thailand to the suburbs of Washington, D.C., with the stated aim to Americanize the kids. I was 9 and remembered being taught by the kids in my neighborhood to play a game called Smear the Queer. Anyone else play that game? Yeah. It was a game with a simple aim, for everyone to run after the person with the ball, tackle them down, pile on top of them, and thus smear the queer. Consequently, for many years, I was upset when people called me queer, though my relationship to the word started to change as the context around the word changed. I'm so grateful for having lived through the 1980s and 90s when we took back the word queer with Queer Nation. Reclaiming a derogatory word as a strength is a way to recenter speech from hateful and demeaning connotations to positive affirmations. So to be uplifting versus denigrating. Not long ago, I had an incident in which I was able to realize the strength from recentering or shifting speech in myself. I used to live near the San Francisco LGBT Center. One day, as I was walking down the as I was walking by the center with a visiting friend who was also a lesbian of color, a white guy was walking down the sidewalk towards us. As we approached the man, I thought to myself, "Oh, he seems really tired." So I smiled at him and said, "Hi." He didn't answer right away, but just as we passed each other, he jeered, "Fucking lesbians." Simultaneously, we, my friend and I, both turned and replied calmly, "Yes, we are." When I first came out, I'm trying to do it from the book here so I can look up. When I first came out, I most likely would have yelled after him with some angry defense. This time, after almost 40 years of being an out lesbian and having overcome much internalized homophobia, I was able to respond calmly, settled in my identity. The attitude I had this time was, "You tried to diss us." I'm sorry, my page is not doing so well, so let me see. "You tried to diss us, didn't work, dude." Another thing that was interesting about the story was observing how my mind tried to deflect the impact of the man's hatred. When we turned, I was trying to read this so I can be looking up. Oh, when we turned to answer him, I saw the L from the LGBT sign on the center was missing. Maybe it had fallen off or broken. I remember I had a quick flash of thought. Oh, he said the word lesbian because the L was missing on the sign over there. In my head, I was making an excuse for him. It was like I was trying to fill in the blank for him. Part of the, I say machination, I guess that's the British way. The North American way is machination. So part of the machination of systems of domination is how we're taught to minimize the impacts of such incidents. Internalized oppression is complex and has many layers. Part of my thinking still went down the groove of internalized homophobia, minimizing the harm of what this man had done. However, in this case, I didn't let it stick and clearly saw it as a minimization and internalized homophobia, seeing the series of processes of seeing how I had agency to stay in the wholeness of my being was a centering moment.